Howdy, listeners. Matias here with your episode 15 intro, and we are back. It's been a while, but we have some cool episodes coming up your way. This is the first of many, I promise. Before I get into the guest today, just want to remind you of a few things. We have a website, launch-learn.com. You can find a type form there to get in touch with us about being a guest on the show. So if you know anybody who would be great to share their story about starting a company, send them our way. LinkedIn, website, you know the deal. You can find us how you want. Also, random shout out to our listeners in Washington, Virginia. Don't know how you found out about us, but let us know. Send us a review, send us a note. Other listeners can do the same. 5 stars only, obviously. Let us know what you like about the show. Give us some tips on who we should get on next. Today's show, though, is about Charlotte de Ridder. We've been trying to have her on the show for a while. Had some scheduling issues, but she is on today. We also had some recording issues, but besides the point, she is a social entrepreneur based in Nairobi, Kenya, working on improving the youth employment rate there through a company called YouCity, of which she is a co-founder. Had a great conversation with her about social entrepreneurship, youth employment, and the future of her education business in Africa. It's going to be a great one. Enjoy.
Do we start?
Yeah, we're live.
All right, great. that was intense. Are we already recording? Oh, this is going to be part of the podcast, isn't it? Charlotte, thank you so much for coming on.
Hi, yes. Thanks a lot for having me.
Great. So, what did you have for lunch today?
So actually, my housemate made banana bread and I had banana bread for lunch. It was amazing. It was so good. Straight out of the oven.
Jealous.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah,
that's definitely better than mine. Cool. So before we get into the startup you're working at the moment, what got you interested in a sort of entrepreneurial journey?
Yeah, really good question. I was thinking about this a lot in my own reflection, and I think I got into my entrepreneurial journey started really young because I grew up in a very entrepreneurial family. Both my parents are entrepreneurs. And so I think for me, it always kind of was a very common, it felt like a really normal path to take when starting a career, as opposed to kind of exploring that later on. Like I think from a really young age, I knew like this sounds like a really great career to have, and it seems like a really great life to be an entrepreneur. And so that was quite inspiring to me. So really, yeah, like the apple doesn't fall very far from the tree.
Very cool. Very cool. So getting into, the company that you co-founded, YouCity, trying to pronounce it right here. Yeah. How did that get started?
Yeah. So YouCity was started 5 years ago, approximately. And it all started with actually seeing a problem. So I came to Kenya, this was 7 years ago, for a short-term project and was working with young people, especially working out of some of the universities here. And something that came up over and over again was the fact that young people had this anxiety of graduating because they would see their friends not getting employed, but also knew that in general, the youth unemployment level were really high in Kenya, and not really knowing where do I start to be able to find a job? And so looking more into it, I realized that there was a big mismatch between kind of the amount of graduates that there are and then the amount of graduates that end up getting placed into jobs. And I was really curious about that. And while I was here is when I had this feeling, I was like, I just want to do this. Kenya is such an interesting country. It's very different from where I grew up. It's very different from the culture that kind of I did my education in, and I think I have a lot to learn from the difference in culture and just this different place. And I also kind of feel ready to try and start my own company. I think it will be even if it fails, a great learning opportunity. And so I called one of my closest friends at the time and asked her, do you want to come and start a company with me? And she was like, yep, that sounds great. So we booked I had to still go back to university and graduate. And so I went back and during my final year, like booked a one-way ticket to Kenya to just explore the problem more. And I really didn't know what the solution was going to be, but I just knew I want to try and figure out a sustainable company that helps young people build sustainable careers so that they can have better lives for themselves and for their community. So that's really where it all started.
Nice. And when you arrived, I mean, why, and you saw this problem, I guess, in Kenya with employment and youth employment in particular, why did you choose a business instead of maybe like joining a nonprofit or being part of some other organization?
So when I attended this conference, and actually while I had decided to move to Kenya and start a company, and one of the founders, actually, you know, one of the directors of Ashoka was there. Ashoka is like one of the biggest social entrepreneurship networks in the world. And I remember him telling me, you know, like the best thing you can do is when you find an idea is you know that your ego is not involved when you're willing to work with somebody else on that idea instead of specifically doing it yourself, unless you realize that there's a need for something different and a need for something new. And I reflected a lot on that because I realized at that point, I was like, I definitely think there's a part of ego in this because there's just no, I think a lot of entrepreneurs have big egos. And I think my ego isn't specifically that big, but I think I wanted to prove to myself that I could do it. It was one aspect, but I always kept in the back of my mind that if it didn't work, or if during the research I saw that other companies were doing similar things, then that's definitely something that I would consider. But the first 6 months when we were doing the research and really looking into the problems and the solution, I realized that there wasn't at that time a company that I felt really excited to join. And I really was, I was seeing more and more like an opportunity that was kind of combining different elements of companies that I saw, but not specifically a company that I saw, and that we could build something that was quite unique. And so I think the combination of kind of the learning journey that I wanted to go on, together with kind of that gap I saw in the market is what made me decide in the end of the day to start my own company rather than join an already existing company. Yeah.
So you mentioned this already that you spent, I think, the first month, maybe 6 months on research, you know, probably finding a problem or doing a problem solution fit. What exactly did you do during this time? I mean, did you talk to different companies, or how do you sort of reach out and find the gap in the market?
What I did is for the first five to six months, it was basically first, even before reaching Kenya, I just went on LinkedIn, went on like anybody that I knew that would be in that sector. And I kind of started with listing the different assumptions that we had coming in, right? Like an advantage of not being from Kenya and starting a company in Kenya was that we knew that we didn't know anything. So everything we thought were assumptions, and every one of those assumptions needed to be debunked and needed to be really like we would needed to really understand, is this assumption true or is it false? So the first months were really like going to LinkedIn, finding somebody in the youth sector, finding young people, finding SMEs, NGOs, corporates, understanding, like meeting them, but with a real like blank canvas of like, all right, I just have questions to understand better what the market is here, questions to understand better what the environment is and what are some of the challenges that young people are facing, but also what are some of the challenges that employers are facing. And it's during that process, every time we meet somebody, then we would be like, okay, like, can you introduce us to three or four more people so that we can talk to them as well? So it ended up just being meeting after meeting after meeting, and every evening coming home and jotting down the different ideas, the different assumptions. And that's kind of how the idea of Yusuti formed. None of the Yusuti wasn't like a, oh, I suddenly have this idea and I'm going to work on that. It was very much market driven. And it came from research that was done over an extensive period of time and digging into the realities of the market.
And how do you know? I mean, 6 months is a relatively long time potentially for research. Like, mm-hmm. Why 6 months? Like, when did you make that? Okay, you know what? We know exactly where to kick off or which solution to build. Why did that decision come at that time?
So, well, we had six, I think we had set 6 months because we had 6 months worth of finances. In 6 months, we either like start something or we just move on. But I think it was 6 months because we, earlier on, we already kind like, I think by about 2 months or 3 months, we already had like a good idea. But then every time we had an idea, then it was about going out there and actually like doing some user research about that particular idea. And so there was a lot of pivoting that happened even before we started, just by then testing out the idea with people and understanding better. And then 2 months approximately were just actually starting, were us trying to, getting our first clients, getting our first students. So when we just started, we didn't have an office, but because we do trainings, we actually needed to have an office to do trainings, but we didn't want to get an office before we knew we had people to train, because if not, we would not be able to afford rent. So we would have this coffee place not far from the house that we would like just sit at every single day for hours. They would get so annoyed at us because we would only order like a bottle of water, because at that time we had so little money left. So, and then people would just come in for interviews and they'd be like, so where is your office? And we're like, it's currently under renovation. Because we knew we can't, like, we understand there's a need for an office, but we want to wait until we have at least 5 paying clients, both employers and young people, before we invest into that. So that took a few weeks to get that. And so 6 months was really the time it took to do all of the research, ideation, like testing, and then actually getting the first 5 paying customers to say, okay, let's get an office now. And yeah, we can actually start this off.
And I'm sure, like, as you're meeting with people, you know, you start with one problem, which is like youth unemployment, and then you kind of see how there's a big network of issues that may relate to that. How do you kind of narrow that down and focus and say, okay, this is what specific issue we want to tackle? And how did you kind of decide what your first value proposition would be?
Yeah, I think what happens is you're totally right. And I think sometimes asking too many questions can just, there's like a phase where it's just about exploration, so you don't filter out. And then there's a phase where it's like, okay, we just can't add new ideas, because if not, we'll never start anything. And that's a very important transition to make. What helped for us was, one, knowing that we wanted our solution to be able to be sustainable. And knowing that we are in the social sector, not all solutions can be sustainable. So there was a part of it was like, we need to build something that, knowing that we're targeting unemployed youth, they're not going to have much money. So we need to find something that they are able to afford, and that like kind of figure out what's the business model. And that's where like we always were like, there has to be a part of it that's company linked. Like, we know young people will never be able to pay the full cost of the training or any like anything like that. So we need to have another way in which that kind of gap is covered. So I think that was one part, kind of having that clarity of sustainability at the back of our head. And I think the second thing is to stay really, to stay really in touch with our mission, and in touch with like our mission, what like is bringing young people into sustainable careers and helping them grow sustainable careers. And that's kind of what we came back to every time, when it was like, okay, but maybe like we realized that, for example, SMEs were also lacking management skills, and therefore young people would get into jobs, but that wouldn't work really well because they would just not want to work there. But we're like, look, our mission is not to help SMEs. Our mission is to help young people. And for us, SMEs is a way to get there, but not the core. So it was very much looking at what is the core that we want to achieve, and understanding what are the really most important problems when it comes to them finding jobs. And the last part was like, we knew that we weren't going to be fundraising to be able to start this. So it had to be something that could be sustainable and sustainable fast.
Mm-hmm. Now this makes a lot of sense. Regarding the first paying users or customers, how do you get these first 5 customers?
It's a very good question, because I don't even remember exactly. I think it was kind of, we were part of different WhatsApp groups. So like putting it on WhatsApp groups that we had this opportunity, posting it on job sites, posting it on Facebook. We were part of a community called the iHub, and we asked them to promote it. So it was a lot of, yeah, it was a lot of just any kind of non-monetary outreach that we could do on the youth side. But also we first got 5 clients. So we said first we need to get 5 employers that are willing to hire through us. And then we'll get the 5 students that we're going to train and place with those employers. And the employers was just knocking on doors and cold calling. I would just search up business lists and call and call and call. And then I would have my housemates were also in like business areas and have like bulk business cards from events they went to. And I was like, just give me all your business cards. So I would just take all of their business cards. I had piles of business cards in my room. And I'd just look at every one of them, call up the number, just try and sell. And I think the 5 first clients that we worked with, like one of them is still a client today, like has been, like she's been taking interns from us since then, like graduates from us since then. And she's told me, she said how much the service has improved like since then. She was like, I now look back and I realize that you didn't really know what you were doing at the time, right? And I was like, no, you really learn as we go. And she's like, you're like, it's so much better now. And I'm like, yes, it's been a few years. Yeah.
So tell us about that. Yeah, the first version, like basically, essentially a trainings program for people to get entry-level sales job, from what I understand. How did you build the curriculum and where did you start?
So actually, we started with not even focusing on sales. We started with kind of like any job. We would go to clients, like any entry-level job you want, we'll find somebody, train them, and then place them in your company. And so our training, and our training was only 3 weeks, and now it's 6 weeks, so it's doubled in time. And in that 3 weeks, we kind of had this very, kind of our curriculum was based on a lot of our own experience in training, and also kind of a lot of research around all the skills that are needed to be successful. I think we were a bit naive when we would have so much training content for 3 weeks, and really like, over time, the more we've been doing this, the more I realized like it's better to have less and go more intense than have so much. And people are like just scratching the surface. So I think in the beginning, when I look back, it was more of like an empowerment program. It was so much like, wow, and like you'll do all these things and you can learn all these skills, and we'll get you a job. And so, which was like still like amazing, and I think very needed. But looking back, it was built a lot on research that also kind of wasn't as pedagogic as what we have right now. I think the advantage that we have had is that because we place our graduates in our training programs as soon as they're finished, and we stay in close touch with the employers, we're basically constantly getting feedback as to how our training needs to be improved. So we've had, I think we're at our 35th cohort now, and our 35th cohort is different than our 34th, and our 34th is different than our 33rd. Every time, mm-hmm. Like the iteration makes sure that we are constantly kind of at the edge of what employers tell us they need in terms of skills. And I think that's really important for the type of program that we run. So the program we run nowadays is nothing compared to what we used to run like 4.5 to 5 years ago.
Regarding the program iteration, I mean, is it more like small minor optimizations for every cohort, or is it more like you really try to go to some 5-10x improvements for each program that you produce?
I think there's been some that have been more iterations, and then there's been some that are kind of much bigger. For example, like the increase of length, we didn't go from 3 weeks to 6 weeks. We went from 3 weeks to 3.5 weeks to 4 weeks to 5, and then now we're at 6 because they keep realizing that there needs to be more time. But for example, the shift to going from, we used to train in general skills and saying like, no, let's move to training in sales skills, has been pretty kind of was a pretty drastic change. And like, that's happened over a period of 6 months through different research and kind of first testing it out and then doing it like full, let's change to fully having a sales training. So it really depends on what, like the iterations cohort per cohort is a lot around the pedagogy and like specific classes that we offer. But then if we go into themes or if we go into like those aspects, kind of when we decide to put on like the change in sales, for example, was a lot more drastic, and it took more looking at the data again of like of all of our employers, what percentage of them hire sales talent? Does this make financial sense, et cetera, to be able to do that and testing it out before making like a full commitment to it.
And where did you find your trainers, or who created the curriculum, especially early on, I guess, or yeah. How did that work?
Me and my co-founder created the curriculum, and yeah, we just taught ourselves a lot around kind of what's needed. But, and again, like we have a lot of experience training thanks to ISEC. So it was a lot linked to kind of our experience around training. And the same, all of our trainers, we actually specifically don't work with trainers that have a lot of education experience and actually like formal teachers, because we realized that the way that teachers are taught is a lot around like, I'm at the front of the room and I'm going to tell you all this information. And that's completely the opposite of what we're trying to do. Our trainer's role is more like coaching. They're there to help you find a voice rather than tell you what your voice should be. And so we often use either graduates of our own training programs that we see seem to have like a natural kind of coaching ability, and then just train them ourselves to learn the Yusuidi way of training. And like we build the Yusuidi way around kind of interaction between trainer and trainee, between trainee and other trainee, between the group, and like what are the principles that we use when it comes to the pedagogy that we use in our trainings. And that's the fundament of the foundation of what we're trying to kind of achieve is there thanks to that kind of training curriculum that was kind of all built by us based on market experience.
And from you know the growth that you have achieved, I mean, at what point, so you mentioned earlier, right, that you started without getting funding, so you wanted to be based on the revenues you generated. I mean, at what point were you like, okay, you know what, it makes sense now to get investments and get funding, and where do you go to get this money?
So even up to this date, we don't have major external investors. So we have a few angel investors that have done some smaller investments. So what we decided is, whatever happens, we want to try and grow ourselves without having to go the VC route or without having to go the social impact route. I have done fundraising. Like it's so exhausting. And also I feel like the expectations, especially being a social enterprise, it's a very tough situation to be in because usually impact investors have, on the one hand, still very, very high expectations of return, but also only want to invest in you if you target like the bottom of the pyramid. And those two just often don't really work together very well. It's one of the biggest dilemmas in social entrepreneurship. And there's a lot of like reading to do about that and research around it of like the balance between sustainability and mission. And so that was always kind of a question there of like, is this really a direction? I know that if I go into pure VC, the mission will most likely have to be compromised because the requirement for return on investment from VC firms is so high. And there's a lot of like people that I know that have gone through that experience and had to face the consequences of raising VC rounds. So that was kind of one aspect, which was really kind of looking critically at fundraising. But then what we decided to do is to actually do grant fundraising for innovative projects and innovative ideas. So whenever we had, so we've had three rounds of kind of looking for grants for new ideas. And the first one, we got grant investment from the Finnish Embassy here in Nairobi to start off this new e-learning platform that provides personalized learning experiences. And for us, because that was high risk, and we said we can't afford to do that, but we really want to try and see if that works and also be able to integrate it into our current program. So let's see if we can do some grant fundraising for that. And so we managed to do that. And then Blue Haven, a family fund in the US, also decided to support us in trying that out. And now this time around, kind of because of COVID, we've had to change our services, and we used to do that place people into jobs, and we realized there's less jobs available. So we also started doing outsourcing services where we hire our own graduates and they do work for our clients, which is also a new service that we're starting, and which is, and because it's quite, it requires some investment as well. Again, I went to look for grant money to try and test that out, and the Finnish embassy is supporting us to test that out and to try and grow that. So my fundraising strategy has been a lot focused on, I have this idea that I want to test out. Let me see if I can find somebody that's willing to back that idea, and they'll back it even if it completely fails, as like a sub-component of the company, but the core program is able to sustain itself.
Okay, that's really interesting, actually. So the core program runs by itself to some extent, and then these sort of experimental hypotheses running in parallel, and then you use the grant for these experiments.
Exactly.
Okay, interesting.
If anyone's interested in social entrepreneurship, you know, Alex wrote a paper on it, so.
Yes, bring back memories. It's been a while.
Yeah.
And you have a very high recruitment rate now of like 87%.
Yeah.
How, I'm sure it wasn't that way to begin with. Like, what have you learned on like how to best train people to get that, to have the most impact when they start the job?
Really staying really close in touch with the employers, because at the end of the day, there's one thing which I'm sure you know, but human beings are challenging. We are not easy to predict. We can be easy to predict, but we're not very rational. And so you can create the perfect training program and you will never reach perfection in behavior change, because every person that will go through it will be different and they'll have different gaps. And the only way, therefore, the only way, therefore, that you can really succeed is if you realize that everybody is different and that you add components of individualization to the training that you do, and leave and make sure that, yes, you have top talent, but you always make sure that the employer understands that at the end of the day, they are still dealing with entry-level talent. One of the biggest things that we work on is changing the idea, and that's really big here. A lot of memes go around about this, which is employers trying to hire entry-level people, and when they hire them, when they look at their CVs and they interview them, they're like, I want a person that's entry level, but I want you to have 6 years worth of experience. Yeah. And there's a really like an unrealistic expectation as to what an entry level person can do. They're supposed to come in the job and know exactly what to do from day one and be able to nearly like lead an area and do everything on their own. And that's just not realistic. Like, think about yourself when you were just starting off. Like, even if you're bright and you're proactive and you're incredibly talented, and you will still in the beginning be like, what is this? What am I expected from? Like, what does my boss want? Yeah. Like, what does it look like to be good at this? You know? And I think that's it. I think that's the challenge, that unrealistic expectation between like what can you expect from an entry level person?
Okay. Little bit of a different question here. So it's coming from since you're a social impact business, when it comes to your KPIs, I mean, how do you balance that between, you know, making sure that you have traction, that you have the revenues, but also, as mentioned, you know, you make the impact in society?
So to track that, it's very much ensuring that the KPIs are, on one hand, financial, like having really clear financial goals, but on the other hand, having really clear mission-driven goals. I think for me, what has been very important is to stay really in touch with what our mission is, and to have the tough conversations around it as well, of like, are we going in the right direction? Is making this, if we make this decision, does it actually align with the mission that we're trying to go towards? But also, like, if we make this other decision, are we going to be able to survive as a company? And so it really comes to having very honest conversations as a company, and yeah, staying closely in touch with what we're trying to, who we are trying to be as a company, and ensuring that people have a safe space to say like, look, I think this decision goes against our values and this decision goes against our mission. It's too money driven. And to say like, yes, that, like, if you believe that that's the case, let's actually talk about it and see what we need to do differently.
Yeah, I think that definitely raises a good point as well that, you know, especially as a social impact business and as you're growing, to really instill that mission in the culture of the company, it must be quite hard as well, I assume. I mean, how do you do that? As you mentioned, you do have these hard conversations, but also, I don't know, do you, you know, I don't know, tell everyone, oh, this is our principle, this is our mission every day, or how do you instill that in the culture?
I think first thing is having the right people on the team. So one thing is that about 60% of our staff are graduates from our own program. And that helps because it means that they know, like, they were there before. They've gone through our training. They understand what we're trying to achieve. They understand kind of the goal we have as a company. So that really helps. But then the other thing is to have, I think one is me as a leader, like me showing that I care about the mission and me showing that I make decisions in line with that mission and in line with our values. And the second thing is something like to have conversations around the values and ensure that they don't just kind of disappear and like are somewhere in a handbook, but that they're actually kind of actively used as part of assessment processes, as part of discussions, and the same with the mission. So I think it's a question of making sure it's top of mind, but really also ensuring that the leaders of the organization act in line with what matters for the company. And therefore, it comes from hiring the right people to induct them in the right way, to ensuring that they have conversations that matter and that they pass those down and to the people that they are managing.
I have a question about the Kenyan market specifically. I know you've been there for around 5 years now.
Yeah.
So probably familiar, like feels more like home to you.
Yeah.
But we had someone on the show who went, started a company in Nigeria, and he had a lot of culture shock in terms of working with people there in terms of their culture and their behaviors. How did you deal with that? I mean, especially with, you know, two Europeans coming in to start a company. Your co-founder, I believe, is from Ukraine.
Yeah.
So how did you deal with kind of that culture, attitude, and the changes that you saw?
Yeah, I mean, there is definitely a lot of cultural difference. And I think that's something that I also had to learn over time while being here. I think the first part was just coming in and starting a training company in an environment where I don't know what the cultural reality is. And therefore, I think a big learning point was, for example, authority is so deeply instilled through education here that we were trying to train in a manner that was like very non-authoritarian, like not using authority, but we realized that people wouldn't submit their tasks, or they would just feel like, oh, I can get away with anything because that's just so different. And because it doesn't make them feel like things are actually serious, and it can, and even backfired. So people are like, this is training isn't as good because it's just not using that same method of education. And I think the interesting part there is really the question the decision you make as a company as to, are you going to therefore just fit into the way that it is? Or do you decide to make shifts? And I think for me, when it came to the company, I really clearly decided this is not how I want to be. I don't want to be like the authoritarian boss that because I'm your boss, therefore, like you should just listen to me and you can't ask me anything. But even that with the team was a lot of work of getting them to open up and realize, like, you know what, like, we are at equal levels and I will not, like, I trust you in your work and I trust that you know a lot of things. So I want you to tell me how to do this better. I want you to tell me what you know, and I want you to challenge me. And even to this day, like any new person that we bring in, that's something that they have to get used to. And it's the same in the training. Like we really had to balance and we try as much as possible to say, look, like we don't want to instill that kind of culture because it can be very oppressive. We want to try and change that, but there is a reality of just how it is, and it's important to not to try and think that we are superior in our way of doing, and that's very important, like to really respect. What that means and respect that I am a guest here and I want to learn from that, because there's other areas of the culture that like I think authoritarian for pedagogy purposes, like I've done a lot of reading about it, aren't the most kind of, it's like short-term gains versus long-term kind of sustainability. But there's other aspects of the culture that I have learned so much from, and like the aspect of community is so present here. And I'm someone that, for example, I really learned to, I go straight to the point. I'm like, I didn't like this, I like this. And I realized that that's really kind of, when I come into a meeting, I should actually ask somebody like, how are you doing? How is your family doing? Like actually show that I care. And it's not, because it's not that I don't care when I don't ask. I think the way that I brought up is like, if you have something to say, don't beat around the bush, you know? But I realized that here, that's not how it is, because before anything else, what matters most is that there's a community, is that it's like you care about each other, you care for each other. If something happens, you have each other's back. And therefore, when you meet somebody new, you don't first ask what you want. You first really try and get to know them, even if at the end of the day, you're only meeting them shortly because you're trying to do a business exchange or something like that, you know? So that's been, and that's been incredible for me to learn about that, because I think that that's very different from how I was brought up.
Yeah, I think just generally in the Western world, as well as Europe, that's something we can improve for sure. Yeah. Moving to another question, which probably have impacted you a lot, as you already mentioned, the whole COVID-19, I mean, how has that been for you? And also in Kenya, I can imagine it must have been really hit really hard from this.
Yeah, I mean, COVID has definitely had an impact economically on the Kenyan economy. And we see a lot with, especially like for us, the two main impacts has been employers letting go of people and freezing their hiring. And in parallel, like the longer COVID has lasted, the more people have had issues to try and raise the money to be able to join our training program. And so the most direct way in which we've had to adapt is that all classrooms were closed. And so the first case hit on a Friday, and by Monday we said everything virtual. So we paused our training for a week, and we took a week to just move everything online and like understand what structure would work online, which software should we use, etc. And then by the end of that week, we were ready to just do the whole training remotely. And so that was like, it was so abrupt, but also a great learning, because I know that we probably will open offices again in a few months. But even then, for me, there's no need to fully go back to in-person. I really want to find a great model between like online learning and in-person learning, because I realized that it can work, and we can have really great impact even remotely. So I think that's the first like most direct one. The employers kind of stalling on employment had a really big impact, because it meant that our employment rates reduced. So less people were able to find work after they graduated, because there are just less work opportunities available. And one of the things we thought a lot, how exactly should we do this? And it's kind of when the idea of outsourcing came, of let's do some research and understand if employers kind of, we know they still want to sell, because if not, their business is going to die. So what can we provide as a service that would enable us to still pay our graduates, maybe a little bit less, but still like kind of help them sustain, but without an employer feeling the pressure that comes from hiring. And that's really when our whole new outsourcing services started, which we do right now, where a graduate can come and work for us selling for a third party. So that changed a lot as well. Our whole team is remote. We actually got rid of our offices for now, because we said it's just a cost line, and we just are honestly, the most important for me all along was like, I want to know that my employees feel safe, that they will not lose their job because of COVID, because that makes a huge difference. Like, it's a tough time already emotionally. I don't want them to also feel financially stressed, that because they're afraid that they might lose their job.
I guess one of the positives that you've seen from going virtual is that you've had people outside Kenya also like use your service.
Yeah.
What are your plans for that? Do you plan to expand, or where do you see your service going in the future?
Yeah, so I think We definitely plan to expand. The core focus, though, right now is how to really master this remote learning. And we're integrating kind of our e-learning platform with our virtual training. And really, the kind of my vision for Usuti is that a person that joins Usuti knows that they are set for life. And that is because once they join Usuti, they get their first job through Usuti. And let's say 3 years later, they decide that they want to shift careers. They can come back to Usuti and we can find them a new job because like we're really expanding our service offering where we're able to kind of provide employers with entry level, mid level and senior level. And the brand building for me is because one day all of these positions will be filled with Usuti alumni. So it's like a person knows that this is a lifelong community that they are part of that will kind of make them know that they have a sustainable career forever because they have Usuti that will help them like until they retire. Mm-hmm. And so a core focus right now is to ensure that that's all put in place so that wherever we expand to, that same model comes in where it's not just about you're joining a training right now and then finding a job, but you're joining a training right now and you have a job for life. And that's like, we don't just want to be that in Kenya. We realize that the service that we are providing is a service that is needed across the African continent and actually is needed in a lot of different countries in the world. And we want to see how is it that we become so good at understanding how to train, how to become like a great talent partner, that we can do that across the continent at first in the next 5 to 10 years.
Do you have a quote you wanted to share with the listeners?
Yeah, I have this quote that every time somebody asks me for a quote, the same quote comes up, and that's since I'm 12 years old. And I know I should change quotes because I should have more diversity, but it's just always it's never let the fear of striking out keep you from playing the game. It's
nice.
It's a baseball reference, which I don't even watch baseball, but I think it's brilliant.
Oh, very cool. Just one last question from my side as well. I mean, definitely since launching, you know, you've been through quite a bit, I imagine. You're in Kenya, which is also quite a unique experience. Yeah, what has been your top three learnings as a startup founder?
Top three learnings is one, never underestimate the emotional roller coaster of being an entrepreneur and make sure that I learned to make sure that I should take really good care of myself emotionally and physically and not prioritize work over my own well-being. That's a big one for me. The second one is to just understand that people change, and when you start a company, you go through so much, and you can't know that the people that are around you will be the same people. And it's important that that business stays business. I think a lot of people have had struggle. Like I really like to speak openly about how hard it is to start a company with a co-founder, like because you have to have a lot of tough conversations, and I think it's important to have those tough conversations, and I think it's important to put things on paper and just to say, look, this is a business. It's not just about trust. It's about like legality. We want to make this a business, so we have to like treat each other like work partners and not just like friends. And I think that changes a lot when it comes to kind of ensuring that whatever happens, you know you have each other's back. Because you know that you have all the tough conversations. It's like such a tough journey that you have to prepare for going through tough times with somebody else. So yeah, I think having tough conversations early and making sure that everything is kind of set on paper, I think is very important. That would be my second learning. And my third learning is that I think regardless of how big a company is, you need to always stay in touch with your customer and with what's happening on the ground to make sure that you achieve your mission. Because what matters is what's happening on the ground, not what's happening in a boardroom. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me and for asking great questions. It was a great reflection for me as well.
Thank you very much for listening. We really hope you enjoyed it. Our captivating theme song is The Vendetta by Stefan Kartenberg. If you want to connect with us or send a guest recommendation, drop us a line at launch.learn@gmail.com or connect with Matthias or myself on LinkedIn. Have a great one and see you next time on Launch and Learn.